Dr. Bill Campbell, thank you for coming on. We appreciate having you here today on the Flatline Fitness Podcast. If you could you give us a brief intro to yourself? What you're looking to do, your academic chops and kind of your background?
Sure, yeah. So I'll start back into my first career just because I had to do a career transition. I started in marketing, selling bug killer and weed killer, and wasn't real passionate about killing bugs and weeds, but I was passionate about lifting weights and sports nutrition. So decided, I'll go back to college and did that, not really knowing. I thought maybe I would want to work for a sports nutrition company, but over time I realized, okay, I think academia is what I was created to do. So I went back, got my master's degree in exercise physiology from Baylor University. They had just started a doctoral program while I was finishing my master's. So I stayed there and got my PhD at Baylor University. Then it was time to get a job, and I asked my wife, where would you like me to work? She says, wherever you want, as long as it's hot. So that cut the country in half. So I applied to all the jobs I could that where they were warm, and very blessed to get hired by the University of South Florida, which is where I've been for the last 14 years now. And I direct the Performance and Physique Enhancement Laboratory, Professor of Exercise Science. And I describe my research as having two focuses, sports nutrition and physique enhancement. So I like fat loss, muscle gain, and I would say something that ties everything together is resistance training. There's always some form of resistance exercise in all the research that I do.
Awesome. That's quite the journey there. It's something we can all appreciate, I think.
Yeah, for sure. So along with that, and so you are, so when you were at Baylor, were you, or was Dr. Willoughby there?
Yes. So
while you were there?
Dr. Willoughby came right at the end of my master's and was there for my entire time as a doctoral student. And I switched to his lab in my last 2 years. So I wasn't with him initially. And then, he goes way back to TCU.
Yeah, he does.
Yeah. It's kind of interesting, the Texas ties that we have, because you would have worked with Dr. Labonte, or have worked with Dr. Labonte. And so that would have been Dr. Tinsley's mentor. Dr. Tinsley was my mentor. Then it's full circle around to the Dr. Willoughby stance on if you can work in his lab or not, which is something Dr. Tinsley told me, that you have to fill out your shirt sleeves if you want to be in this lab. We've transitioned away from that, but that's kind of what I remember as far as connections with Dr. Willoughby and everything. And so I tell my grad students as a joke that now, just for fun. But to go alongside with kind of your primary areas of research, I was really interested in just getting, the type of individual that you work with in your research seems to be very specific. Can you explain like the type of participant you would have for most of your studies?
Yes, I'd love to talk about that. So what I do is I really like studying bodybuilders. Mm-hmm. I did a bodybuilding show when I was younger, and I really like, I would say bodybuilding is what got me into the profession, my love for bodybuilding. But as you can appreciate, there's nobody going to do a study with 40 bodybuilders, because no bodybuilder is going to let you tell them what to eat, how much, and the type of training. So I do the next, what I would say, the closest thing to that, which is resistance trained people who are also lean. Now, it just so happens, at first I was making a concession. I'm like, well, I can't study bodybuilders. And believe me, I've tried. And I live in Tampa. And if there was ever a university or a fitness bodybuilding oriented community where it could be done, it would be done here.
Yes.
So it's not that I haven't tried, and we've done some case series studies. We've done some things in bodybuilders, but not only, I mean, again, initially I thought, well, I'm going to just concede, but now I've actually grown to like embrace. So these subjects that I have now, I would say they're recreational bodybuilders. They don't really plan on competing, but they want to be lean. They want to be jacked. They want to have, you know, big glutes if they're females. So the way that I like to describe my research is I do think my research helps people optimize their physiques within a maintainable lifestyle. So it's bodybuilders that are a little scaled back that aren't quite as intense as what a competitive bodybuilder would be. So if anybody wants to look, I'll say better, but better for them. If they want to be a little leaner and they want to build muscle, that's who my research focuses on.
Perfect. And I do want to kind of reiterate how difficult it is to actually study bodybuilders. And so, you know, most or all research is really hard to conduct, specifically dietary interventions are hard to conduct. Whenever we were doing our studies in bodybuilders, it was almost impossible to get them to shift their diet to the day before so that we could actually do body composition measurements on them or shift their exercise. Well, I have to work out late today. Okay, well, now we have to push back your visit for a couple of days because we're full the next day, right? And they're very, very rigid in some of the things that they do, or they're very committed to what it is that they're doing. And so it is really difficult to actually study them. But I guess along with that is, as far as wanting to help the kind of, not, I wouldn't say average individual, but the resistance trained individual, do you have any specific kind of cutoffs for what you would consider, you know, I guess eligibility requirements for resistance trained or active? Or kind of how do you perceive an individual? Do you do subjective analysis? So, okay, they look like they lift, or they actually have some objective measurements for it.
Yeah. Over the years, we've used different criteria. So one study that we published in 2018, it was resistance trained females, and they had to self-attest. This is just one study, so I'm going to give you a range.
Sure.
They had to self-attest to at least 6 months of following a regimented program. And then we had them, they had to deadlift 1.25 times their body weight to get into our study. Now that demonstrates, yes, they have a strength, they have a given level of strength, but it's also possible that they could have been lifting for 10 years, just never deadlifted. So that's not perfect. But what I liked about that was we eliminated certain females or certain subjects because they couldn't do it. And I'm thinking, I don't think they actually lifted or they just started. So I actually like that objective criteria, even though there's holes in it. I think typically what we're doing is just, yes, the self proclamation of I've been training for 1 to 2 years without doing an objective measure. That's kind of where we're at. And because I do fat loss studies, we always use usually what's been a BMI of less than 25.
Yeah.
But even that gets tough because if it's a resistance trained population, which is normally the case, well, if you got somebody who's got a lot of muscle, now they're over 25 and they're not overweight. So I'm just trying to think of our different weight loss studies. Also, I do a lot of female stuff. So I do, it's not like this BMI is getting nearly as inflated as they would in males.
Sure.
So if I were to work solely with male resistance trained people, I probably would have to go to or feel better about a body fat percentage. But I will say at the end of the day, the subjects, if I look at the other people doing this research, our subjects are always leaner. So we get pretty close to an off-season bodybuilder, I would say. I think our females normally in the high teens, males in the mid-teens, low teens, as a typical example. So we're getting the population that I like, but it's not perfect.
Right. And so you actually already answered kind of the next thing I was going to ask you, which is about what the average body fat percentage of the individual or of your research participants would be. So I guess along with that, or as an extension of that, about how much, you know, because these are resistance trained individuals, they want to enhance their physique. What's kind of the magnitude of weight loss that you generally see within your studies? I guess, obviously it's going to be based on the duration of the study and, you know, the restriction that requiring them to do. But about how much do you usually see as far as magnitude goes?
Yeah, I'm trying to think. I my focus just right now, what I'm able to recall is based on body fat percentage, we usually get 1 to 2%, and that's as little as 2 weeks, depending on what study we're doing, and never more than 8 weeks. Well, we did one study that was 10 weeks. So it's usually about 2%. Now, something we have to appreciate there is if I have somebody starting a study and they're 30% body fat and we get them to 28, that's one thing. But to take a female from 16 to 14, that 2% is still 2%, but that's a much different 2% than when we're starting high. So they might not seem like much, but in our world of dealing with lean people, every percent of body fat percentage loss is, and in fact, to my audience, I always say, if you lose 1% per month where you're very consistent with your diet, I said, that's really good progress. So there's some context to that. If I think back to some of the weight loss, it's going to be skewed because what we've done over the years is we've kind of developed or embraced the research to protect muscle mass. And the last two studies we've done that were dieting studies, that they've retained all of their fat-free mass. So they're losing weight, but it's not much. It's usually probably like 1 to 2 kgs. 2 kgs would be on the upper end. But remember, that's almost solely from the fat mass compartment because of, and I'll just say, their resistance training under supervision. Mm-hmm. And they're having high protein while they're in a caloric deficit. And those two things really help maintain muscle mass. But it's to the point now where I almost want to study the loss of muscle, and it's hard to do that with our current
system. Yeah, no, and you basically hit on exactly what I almost assumed that you would hit on and wanted you to get after, which is that difference in percent from somebody who's 30% going down to 28% versus somebody who's 16% going down to 14%. It's a huge difference, especially if that 16 to 14 was in a female participant, right?
Yes. Yep.
And so, you know, here at Southern Mississippi, I'm teaching our sports nutrition courses, and that's something I try to hit on pretty frequently. Like, okay, I know it says it's only 3% difference, but if that's a 3% difference in an Olympic athlete, right, or a highly resistant trained person, somebody who's getting on stage, that's a huge percent. That's winning, losing, that's meddling, right?
Yes, absolutely.
And so that's a great
just the effort is so much more difficult to lose body fat when you're already lean, like to get that extra amount. It's the hill is that much steeper.
As the closer you get to that, you know, stage ready look, the harder it is, you know, for bodybuilders to lose that final bit of weight. You know, it's a struggle, and that's what makes and breaks the average from the above average right there. Mm-hmm.
And so then I guess along with that, and so you had just kind of commented on, you know, the preservation of muscle mass, which is, I think, where recently a lot of the kind of focus has been on as far as weight loss studies go. And it's been kind of a thing for quite a while now, but I feel like I'm seeing it more often, or at least we're designing strategies to be more based around preserving fat-free mass while we are losing fat. And so you did hit on the consistent protein consumption, right, during those types of interventions. And so kind of talk about some of the studies you've done with those and what you found as far as how much protein that you've employed versus, you know, high, low protein versus, you know, caloric or, you know, amount of caloric restriction, resistance training, and just some of the studies that you've done there.
Yeah, I'm thinking just off the top of my head. I think we've done 4 weight loss studies in resistance trained individuals. 2 of those studies were in males and females, and the other 2 were in females only. And we've ranged from I think 2 of them were 1.8 grams per kg. The other one was 2, and our most recent weight loss study was 2.2 grams per kg. So a gram per pound, as high as a gram per pound, and as low as probably about 0.8 grams per pound or 0.85, somewhere in there. But the other thing to consider is as they're dropping their calories, especially this last study, we did a very, what I called a rapid fat loss study. It was only 2 weeks, but it was a near 40% caloric restriction. And we did require the subjects to ingest 1 gram per pound. And it was, they did it. But man, some of those subjects, especially some of the smaller subjects, it was almost all of their calories was coming
from protein.
That's incredible.
No, yeah, it is really interesting. So whenever you're doing those types of studies with that kind of severe restriction, you know, and high protein content, you see that you kind of preserve that fat-free mass. What happens with performance usually? Do you continue to measure performance throughout those?
Yeah, I have not. We've not done much with performance. Trying to think. The one study we did, it was a high versus low protein study. And these were in females who were recently resistance trained. So they were clearly not highly resistance trained, but to some extent, they reduced their calories by 17% and they were on low protein. but they didn't lose any strength. That was a squat and deadlift for our strength components. And that's the only study. So that was interesting. That kind of, if I were to, and I just actually lectured on this the other day, that went against what I would think. Cause I, you know, one of my pillars of weight loss is high, keep protein high, but they didn't. That was part of the study design. They had to eat low protein. So they did eat low protein, but they didn't lose much muscle mass. On average, they didn't lose any. A third of them did, a third actually gained a little, and a third stayed the same. Mm-hmm. But they didn't lose any strength over the 8 weeks of which they were in a caloric deficit with low protein. And I think two things explain that. One, they were in a supervised resistance training study. And, mm-hmm. and you know, if you're supervised, you don't miss workouts. You have people barking at you every set, like, hey, do more, do more. So the intensity was probably higher than ever for them. And I just think that primarily, along with the fact they weren't highly resistance trained, probably helped keep their strengths from going. And actually they got stronger throughout the 8 weeks.
Right. Yeah. I was thinking maybe potentially in that study in particular, it would have been maybe their previous resistance training status. It leads me to think about actually, one of the original case studies that actually you and I had both authored together with Dr. Tinsley. Yes. With the female bodybuilder. And that's almost what we saw, was that although she was able to maintain her fat-free mass kind of, or all the way up to the first show that she did, you would see that drop in some of that, or in those performance markers. And so I think, you know, maybe just status has quite a bit to do, you know, with whether or not they're able to maintain strength during those types of deficits. Right. But that also leads me to or kind of comment on one of the studies that you've done. And I have to make the disclaimer is that as I was in dissertation mode April, May, in that time, we had kind of started doing our podcast a little bit after that. So I was definitely in dissertation mode, not reading, you know, the publications that I'm interested in mode. So I was like, well, there's no study out there that has done flexible dieting in resistance trained individuals. And so I said that on our podcast, and then I'm like, wait, I should probably go look that up. And then of course I see the study that, that you've done. And so
that was just published recently though. So you couldn't have been too far off.
No, I didn't think so. But as soon as I said it, I was like, I said that and I'm not 100% certain on that right now. So let me go back and look. And so then of course I saw that study and was reading through it. And it kind of has brought me to this question, which would be, okay, we know that the calories are the kind of umbrella of most important thing, right? Actual energy intake, and that underneath that umbrella, you would want to consider protein for fat-free mass maintenance alongside resistance training to increase your physique. Can you explain kind of what happened with your flexible dieting study? And just to say that, okay, we control calories, we control protein. What happens whenever you kind of do a rigid or a flexible strategy within whatever's left?
Yeah. So one thing, and I'm sure you guys will never do this, but that study was done like in 2016 and it wasn't published until this year, I think. Now, to be fair, we submitted that for publication about a year and a half ago, right before COVID hit. And then COVID hit, then my world got turned upside down. Sure. Just, you know, in the middle of study. So I was like, I will handle this some later date.
But we've been there.
Yeah. So that study, yes, it just got published this year, but that's been, again, that was back years ago. And I want to give credit to Lauren Conlon. She was my master's student at the time, and she coordinated that study. We designed it. I remember sitting with Lane Norton. The three of us were just, you know, coming up with ideas for this, but she coordinated that entire study. And essentially, right now everybody thinks, well, flexible dieting, of course, it's just as effective. There was a time when we weren't sure that you could eat these, you know, foods that weren't the holy grail of bodybuilding, and people question. Now nobody questions it, but there was one time, and had we published that, you know, right when we finished it, I think it would have had a more of an impact than what it had now. But what we did was a 20-week study. And it was two phases, a 10-week diet phase and a 10-week post-diet phase. So let's focus on the diet phase first. One group was given a registered dietitian meal plan, and they said, eat this. There were a few choices, but not many. So it's not like it was completely, they had to eat broccoli and chicken breast for every lunch for the entire 10 weeks. But literally each meal had like four exchanges, so that their options were very limited. So we called it a rigid meal plan. The other group, we said, oh, and by the way, they had to reduce their calories by 25% as they were going through this diet. The other group, we said, you're also going to reduce your calories by 25%, but eat whatever you want. The only rules are both groups have to get 1.8 grams of protein per kilogram of body mass, and you have to reduce your calories by 25%. So they both did that for 10 weeks. And this was that was actually the first weight loss study I had done at USF. So we didn't supervise that study. So since that time, we've supervised all of our training studies. But at the end of the 10 weeks, there was no differences in weight loss, body fat loss, retention of muscle mass, lean body mass. It was the same across the board. So our conclusion was probably what most people would expect. Whether you choose a rigid meal plan or a flexible dieting strategy, both are effective for inducing fat loss as long as caloric deficit is present. The other part of the study was the post-diet phase, and that's where we told all of the subjects, do whatever you want. If you were currently tracking for 10 weeks, continue tracking, don't track, we don't care. Just come back and let us test you in 10 weeks. And they did, and we found one significant difference, and that was the group that was in the flexible dieting group, they happened to gain significantly more lean body mass than the group that was originally assigned to the rigid plan. So some people, and I mean, rightfully, you could say, hey, there's something anabolic about coming out of a flexible dieting strategy. Sure. I don't feel comfortable with that interpretation because we didn't control anything. There was nothing controlled. Mm-hmm. But we did look at, did they exercise more? No, the time was the same. Did they eat more calories? Did they have more protein? No. Now, also remember, we didn't supervise them, so they could have exercised more intensely, but we don't know that. Mm-hmm. The only theory we've came up with, and this is, I'm going to admit, we were reaching, but you have to theorize something. That's how research works. The only thing we came up with was, is it possible that when they were allowed to choose their food choices for those 10 weeks, did they have less anxiety? Were they able to just relax more? And we know that based on some research out of University of Texas from John Bartholomew's lab, if you have more anxiety during like finals week, you don't adapt as favorably to your resistance training as you do when you don't have as much daily stress. So that was the only thing we reached for. Did we measure stress? No. Did we? Again, it was 10 weeks after the fact. So in theory, they could have all not tracked anymore as well. So we don't know. And so at the end of the day, I think the take home message from that study is flexible dieting works just as good as a meal plan. Choose whatever plan is going to be better for you. And I'm not confident with any other conclusions from our study, even though we found that one significant difference.
Right. And yeah, I think, you know, that speaks to me. And I think, Gary, you would probably agree that we grew up, and you said Lane Norton's name. So we grew up in the Lane Norton Pop-Tart era.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Which I'm sure he would appreciate that. And so that's kind of a model that we've kind of, you know, at least agreed with for quite a bit of time. And we were around in that period where that was or under contention. Now, not the Pop-Tart itself, but flexible dieting was, you know, pretty or argued against. Which is interesting because I'm guessing that you've seen some of the American College of Clinical Nutrition review that just got published on the carbohydrate insulin model.
Yeah, I have not read it. I've heard other people's impressions of it.
Right, and so I think, you know, obviously, so there's still some disagreement between things like flexible dieting, and then just calories being kind of the umbrella on you know what matters as far as weight loss goes and everything like that. But I think it just goes along with just how you can fit the diet to your needs, right? And that whether, you know, people would always kind of argue, I guess, or not argue, but suggest that keto is good or keto is bad, or this diet is good or this diet is bad. Well, as long as protein and calories are controlled, kind of whatever else you want to fit in there, whether it's keto or not, tends to work, right? But I guess, would you agree or do you?
No, my thoughts on keto are just generally, I think it's a great diet for some people. For people who can adhere to it, I think it's great. for fat loss, I'm aware of two studies that were intervention-based studies where they controlled for calories, they controlled for protein, and a ketogenic diet was no more effective. Mm-hmm. I would also say, though, I know of some other research that ketogenic diets help with hunger better. They suppress hunger better, and that's huge. I think that ultimately, hunger is what makes us lose. It's what beats me when I fail in my diet. So again, ketogenic diets, I think, have a role. Are they going to cause more fat loss? No, but could they help people adhere better? Yes, certain people. Where I think they are limited is if you're trying to build muscle mass. So I'm aware of a few studies, either molecularly based or applied studies, where they do not seem to optimize the anabolic stimulus from resistance training as much. Now, I say all of that. I'm at a point where I tell people, you've got to, what do you want to do? Do you want to lose fat or do you want to gain muscle? Go all in on that. Now, again, not that you don't try to protect muscle when dieting and not that you want to gain a bunch of fat if you're trying to gain muscle. But I think people dance a little too much when they're in a fat loss phase or if they're in a muscle gain phase. They're not really embracing what they say they want to do. And I've identified a third phase, which is maintenance/body recomposition. So that's a perfectly viable phase. Just don't resist the temptation when you're in a fat loss phase to shortchange yourself to actually losing fat and vice versa in a muscle building phase.
I think a lot of people get caught in that trap of wanting to build muscle and not being able to fully committing to that phase and being okay with, I'm going to put on a little bit of body fat and I'm going to have to be okay with that. Or committing fully to a cutting or dieting phase, I might see a little bit of muscle loss. You know, we can attenuate that a little bit, but I'm going to have to be okay with that. And so people live in this weird, you know, middle space and they don't see a lot of progress. And that's what I always try to preach to people is, okay, we're going to do this. We're going to commit one way or the other. So it's good to hear that because it works, you know?
Yes. Yep. No, I think you nailed it. It's tough. And I appreciate it. And here's something else that I've kind of been just grappling with in my mind. When you go on a diet and you do lose muscle mass, I mean, technically fat-free mass, whatever. I just like to say muscle mass. Most people can associate with
sure.
But since I'm talking to two scientists, I guess I'll say it. Fat-free mass and lean body mass are not 100% contractile, but there's a clear association. If you lose fat-free mass, you've lost some actual contractile tissue. If you've lost lean body mass, you've lost some actual contractile tissue. Same thing if you've gained. So there's a direct association, but I do know they're not the same. But again, in my Instagram world, nobody cares.
Yeah, of course not.
I know. Sorry, go ahead. I was going to say, I catch myself because I came from Dr. Tinsley's lab. I'm like, there's overlap, but let's just say muscle for the time being.
Yeah, well, God bless you, because coming from his lab, he's like a walking encyclopedia of
body. Oh my gosh, brilliant, like
the expert's expert on mm-hmm. that. Yeah, and in fact, he could, I would be fearful if he were to ever critique my terminology. But you go on a fat loss phase, and you lose some muscle mass, whatever you want to call it. That's not gone forever. It's going to come back, and it actually comes back very quick. Now, that's not to say, there is a downside to that. That is still time that you didn't build new muscle mass. But, and I think I'm guilty of this, I think I'm guilty of overplaying, you may not lose any muscle. You're going to lose some. You're going to get it back pretty quickly. Let's not sweat that, especially if you actually want to lose fat.
Yeah. And so, yeah, for sure. And so you said it kind of right before we had gotten into that is, you know, the role of refeeds and diet breaks. And so can you kind of discuss what maybe define for us what, you know, that entails or a refeed or a diet break, and then some of the research that you've done as far as that goes?
Yeah, yeah. So we published a narrative review on this. Dr. Escalante was the primary mm-hmm. author. And in that narrative review, we try to define the terms. And diet break, if you hear the word break, think of that as at least 1 week, typically two or more weeks of taking a break from your diet. And that means going back to maintenance calories, maybe even slightly above that. A diet refeed is very similar, but instead of a week, it's usually one or consecutive days of a break from your diet. So refeed, think of 1 to 2 days. Diet break, think of a week or longer. We published one study that was 2020 on refeeds, and I can explain that one. And we literally just submitted a diet break study, the revisions, probably about 2 weeks, maybe even last, now 2 weeks ago, we submitted the revisions for an actual diet break study. And also I need to shout out Madeline Siedler. Do you know Madeline? She's with Dr. Tinsley now.
Yeah, we talk every now and then just on Instagram. Okay. But that's about it. I haven't met her yet.
Yeah, so she's just phenomenal. And I was so excited when she was gonna, you know, when she wanted to study with Dr. Tinsley and then there was actually room for her. I gave him the best compliment I could ever give. Like if my daughters were gonna go study with somebody, I would want him to be who they study with. And I told Madeline that, so I'm very happy for her. So which one do you wanna talk about first? The refeed, but that one's already published, or the diet break?
Garrett, is there any or one in particular you're more interested in?
Let's do refeeds, because this is something that I personally was looking into a lot and struggling with, coming to terms with, like on my last prep for my last bodybuilding show, conversations with my coach about it, Steve Hall, So just kind of like coming to terms with that was kind of nice. Like, okay, maybe this is something that I do need every once in a while when you kind of earn it. So yeah, let's go there.
Yeah. So that was a study we published in 2020, and not without controversy, as I learned after the fact, with some of the criticisms, and we can get into that as well. But essentially what we did was we had resistance trained males and females. It was a 7-week diet. Both groups, everybody in the study did a 25% caloric deficit on average every week. One group, we said, you're gonna reduce your calories by 25% every day for 7 straight weeks. That was the continuous group. The other group was the refeed group. They were allowed to go increase their calories on the weekends. But what that meant was Monday through Friday, they had to decrease their calories by 35% because on Saturday and Sunday, they were at 100%. But that averaged to the same caloric deficit of 25% every week. So they did that. And again, we supervised every workout, every set, every rep, very laborious if you're going to do this as a research group. And at the end of the 7 weeks, we had this was the first study that I've done where I actually found something other than that, the flexible dieting study. But again, I think that was just a chance finding, but this was the first study. I had done several powerlifting studies before, even other weight loss studies, and just nothing. So this is like, wow, the data is like screaming at me here. The difference was the group that did the refeeds, that took a break every weekend, they maintained their dry fat-free mass significantly better than the other group. And if you just look at changes from baseline, they maintained their fat-free mass better, and they lost half, their metabolic rates were suppressed, but it was suppressed half as much in the refeed group as compared to the other group. So our conclusions were that this refeed seemed to help preserve lean body mass or fat-free mass better. And it did so significantly with dry fat-free mass. And when I say that, I just mean when we accounted for total body water, when we took that and essentially made it a practical 3-compartment model, they retained their dry fat-free mass significantly better. And why did that happen? So my theory is twofold, one a little more broad. The group that didn't take any breaks, they were in 7 weeks of what I would call a catabolic state. Everything about dieting is catabolic. You're breaking down fat, hopefully. You also are breaking down muscle. The other group, for every 2 days out of 7, they were not in a catabolic state. They were likely in an anabolic state because as the diet went on, their metabolic rate went down, and now they're probably in a caloric surplus. So just globally, they're not in a constant catabolic or energy deficit state for 7 straight weeks. The other theory, and this is theory because we didn't measure insulin, but 2 days of high carb clearly we would anticipate insulin levels would be elevated. And one of the things that we know about insulin is that it's a pretty powerful anti-catabolic, or it helps preserve or suppress muscle protein breakdown. So that would be my mechanistic theory as to why they maintain that better. Mm-hmm. The other thing is, yes, they maintain dry fat free mass better, but let's just say that's a chance finding. But you also have this metabolic rate. So the group that didn't take any breaks, their metabolic rates, resting metabolic rates, were suppressed by 80 calories on average. The other group only had a 40 calorie reduction, which was not significantly different than baseline. So the resting metabolic rate data supports the retention of fat-free mass that we observed as well. So that's that study in a nutshell.
Yeah. So what happened with some of the controversy along with that study?
Yeah, so two main criticisms. One of them, I think it was a great criticism. The other one, I would say not at all. The first one was we didn't analyze the data on the subjects who dropped from the study. So the what scientists would call a intention to treat analysis. So I have my own, I'll say I have two responses to that. One just personal, and then two professional. So personally, I could care less if people, I don't care what happens. If you don't follow the program, I don't care. I think you bias your study outcome with athletes when you factor in the fact that they didn't follow the program. So again, if you don't follow the diet, I just tell people, yeah, assume that you won't lose any fat. Like, let's just go with that. But I'm not going to analyze your data.
Right.
You're essentially, and I don't want to say you're dead to me, but your data is not valid to me if you didn't follow the plan. What I want to do, my question is, if you follow the plan, if you follow the diet as we prescribed it, I want to know what the outcome was. Mm-hmm. Now, back to my professional criticism, that's how research is done in our field. I don't think you'll find one study in our sports nutrition research, and again, I can't find any where they did an intention to treat analysis. Where it's very common is in clinical nutrition, obese people losing weight. Mm-hmm. It's all over the place. So the group, and I have a lot of respect for the group that had these criticisms. They're better researchers than I am. But their criticism that we should have done an intention to treat, I'm just like, that's just not how our field operates. It's not the standard of the sports nutrition in athletes, resistance trained people. Because I think we all appreciate we don't assume if you don't follow the diet, you're not going to lose weight. We all know that. The other criticism was I was saying that there was there were significant differences with lean body mass, and they made a good point. And I said, I wish I would have said or emphasized dry fat-free mass. That was the only variable that had a significant interaction. The other ones were significantly different than baseline, but there was no interaction effect. So I should have chosen my words. And again, we're talking to just nerdy scientists here. The general population doesn't care less about this, but my words should have been chosen better in my conclusion. Now, that being said, all of my data, and I made the data is publicly available. That's why they were able to go in and they actually reanalyzed the data, and they came to the same conclusions I did, the same actual statistically significant outcomes that I did. So there was nothing wrong with the analyses. It was just, My language was a little sloppy in my conclusions paragraph.
Sure. Yeah. No, I totally get that. But obviously, an important study for you to do. But I would agree that, yeah, we typically don't do the ITTs or intention to treat analyses. And if you do them, you do them both ways, right? You do the do them with people or with them included and with them or without them included, right?
I'll say this. In our diet break study, we did do an intense, Madeline wanted to do it. And I was like, okay, I've never done it before, but she's like the most amazing person in the world. So it was like, okay, if you want to do it, let's do it. So we actually did that. What do you see? I mean, I think it's probably going to gain momentum in our space. I see that happening.
Well, I think it's happening a lot because it's getting harder for us to take, you know, things we do with exercise physiology, exercise science out of the clinical world right now, with just our trajectory that we're going in just the public health sphere, right? As far as obesity is increasing and everybody's gaining weight and things of that nature. So it's getting really hard to take exercise science and, you know, clinical, let's say clinical populations, non-athletes, people who aren't going to be in your lab, let's say doing the physique enhancement type of things. And we can't really separate those anymore. So we're kind of getting that transition from clinical work or clinical analyses into our field. And I think it will increase and gain momentum in that regard. But I think a really cool thing that you had said as far as that study goes was the importance of maintaining that resting metabolic rate that you have with the refeed, right? Can you kind of explain, let's say things like adaptive thermogenesis or adaptive metabolism and how that plays a role in, let's say, weight regain or just our weight loss in general and how you can improve, let's say, fat loss efficiencies and things of that nature with things maybe like refeeds. I guess maybe that'd be more diet breaks that you would see better fat loss efficiency. Maybe I'll let you speak on that.
Yeah, that's what the Matador study showed. I just think in general, under the assumption that the number one predictor variable of metabolic rate is lean body mass, if we agree on that. Now, again, technically it's body weight, but
sure.
From a body composition viewpoint, metabolic rate will follow muscle mass. If you gain muscle, your metabolic rate goes up. If you lose lean body mass, metabolic rate goes down. So that's why I think it's extremely important that you have a prioritization of maintaining your muscle mass in a diet for many reasons. One is the protection of metabolic rate. If your metabolic rate gets suppressed in a diet, it's the day that diet ends, you now have made it more difficult for you to maintain that fat loss. And you've actually increased the likelihood that you're going to gain fat back. And we know with crash dieting or some of these more severe caloric restricted diets, a Minnesota starvation study being one of them, there's a significant fat overshoot. So when muscle mass is lost, after the diet ends, within weeks, these subjects are gaining back much more body fat than what they had to start the diet with. And based on my interpretation of the data, if you can protect muscle mass, you prevent fat overshoot. It's almost like you've never dieted. You've lost fat. But if you've maintained the muscle mass, you prevent one thing would be a hyperphagic response, which is an uncontrolled desire to eat. The best data that I see on that tells me that that's a muscle issue, a fat-free mass issue. Mm-hmm. Some people would suggest that it's body fat, but I don't think that the data supports that. I think that's it. So if you don't protect muscle mass, what happens is your metabolic rate goes down. And in some instances, you use the term metabolic adaptation. Your metabolic rate goes lower than what you would anticipate with just a loss of body weight.
Right. Yeah, and it's interesting what you talk about with the hyperphagic response and that being associated with fat-free mass. So I actually just submitted a narrative review on that exact thing. So that's what my research has been. And so I kind of not shamelessly, but unintentionally put in the ketogenic diet into our conversation a little bit earlier. Not because I'm a proponent or an opponent of a ketogenic diet, but that's something that I've discussed and researched pretty frequently as far as appetite goes. But yeah, the hyperphagic response would be definitely related to things like fat-free mass. So if you can protect that, you can eliminate that outright. Plus, RMR, so let's say energy expenditure is going to drive appetite itself. And then if RMR is going to make up the most considerable proportion of, energy expenditure, then it makes sense that, fat-free mass driving RMR, fat-free mass and appetite would all be related. Kind of down this downstream effect, right? It's kind of cool in that regard. Now I do kind of want to maybe get into really quickly the diet breaks and what the difference between a diet break would be and a refeed, and then maybe what an intentional versus an unintentional diet break would be. Or I guess a plan versus unplanned. Maybe that's a better way to describe it.
Yeah, so let me start there. In my opinion, and this is based on some of the data from Sainsbury, who was part of this Matador study, most of the research on diet breaks doesn't show that it's helpful. It's never harmful. So you're never going to gain extra fat from doing this. But in the few studies where it's worked, where a diet break has been helpful in either maintaining muscle mass or causing even greater losses of fat mass, it's when the diet break was prescribed and they actually came out of a deficit. They went back to maintenance calories. So I have two implications to this. If a diet break is going to work, it has to be fixing something. So, and what I mean by that is if you're not losing muscle mass in your diet, if you're not going on a crash diet, I don't think you should expect a diet break to help with anything. There's no utility for its value. Now, again, it never hurts. But in the Matador study and in our study, the refeed study, which we'll loosely categorize them as nonlinear dieting, there was harm done in both cases with the diet alone. The diets were either severe enough or the protein wasn't high enough where the subjects were losing muscle mass, suppressing metabolic rate. So the refeed or the diet break had utility to help fix that problem. All of the other studies, the one that just was published, I think it was earlier this year by Dr. Peos, the study that we just submitted, there was no benefit of a diet break in those studies. And if you look at those studies, there was not much muscle mass loss, that there was no real harm done in the diet. So again, I think that guides things. And then the last thing that you mentioned was a plan versus an accidental diet break. Every time they work, they're always prescribed. So the subjects knew, I'm going on a diet break this week. What I think is not good, or where there could be potential harm and you wouldn't expect benefit, is you're on a diet and you fail. You didn't drive by the Taco Bell and you went to McDonald's afterwards, and you had this lapse, and then you justify it by saying, oh, I'll just count this as a diet break. There's no evidence that that works. The evidence that's out there is a prescribed and known time for this. So it's planned.
So I guess I would say, Garrett, I didn't know if you had anything that you wanted to kind of comment with that, since that's more in your area.
No, I mean, it's just, it's good to hear that. Because I see a lot of people do what you just talked about, kind of, okay, this is going to be my diet break, or this is going to be my refeed, whatever they're calling it. And so it's just kind of reassuring to know that, you know, what I'm doing with some of my clients and whatnot, when we're establishing like, okay, we're going to diet for this amount of time. And then when we get to X point, we're going to implement, your diet break. This is where, what's going to be seeing the results, you know? And so now it's good to see that this is what the data backs, and this is why we're doing it.
So along with that, or if you're trying to do a planned diet break, right, and you kind of say that something has to, you have to be fixing something in order for the diet break to actually, you know, benefit or provide you with some kind of high degree of benefit, what type of monitoring do you, or would you recommend, I guess, right, as far as, because you need to know that something's going wrong. So what type of monitoring is, I guess, best for knowing when to assign a diet break?
Yeah, so this is where I'm going to separate myself as a scientist, as if I were a coach. Now, I know, Garrett, you are a coach. So this is what I think I would do in your case, because the science says you're taking a diet break at week 3, at week 6, and week 9. And that's great for research, but that's not how I would coach somebody. I would, as a coach, I'm having a conversation with my client, and I'm saying, we're going to agree together on what the criteria is for when we will take a diet break for you. So basically, when you're not responding anymore, let's define what that means. And I would start with maybe 2 consecutive weeks of no fat loss, despite a very high adherence to the diet and the exercise plan. But that way the client is living in this, hey, this is planned. We discussed before we started, if I have 2 weeks where I didn't lose fat, that we were going to plan a diet break. Now it's just like the research. It's planned, but it happens to be planned on biofeedback rather than on some arbitrary time point.
Gotcha. Yeah. And I think, like you said, it's important to separate yourself as the researcher and as the actual, you know, coach or, you know, practitioner, so to speak. Because like you said, you know, there's no utility in assigning those diet breaks at 3 weeks, 6 weeks, 10 weeks, if nothing, if you can't identify that something's actually, you know, going wrong, and that's going to be individualized, you know, between, you know, every person that you're working with. Gary, you could speak to that as far as the differences in all of your clients.
Oh yeah. And what you would see. I tell my athletes or my clients that I'm seeing, you know, some amount of time down the road before we're able to establish what kind of pattern we need to implement with you as far as your dieting goes, because I need to see how you as an individual are responding to these different things so I can identify what you're successful at and what your problem areas might be. You know, that comes down to it, to the whole patience thing, if they're able to even last through our testing period, you know. So
yes.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. But yeah, I think we are getting close to our time to have to let you go, Dr. Campbell. I did want to get into the intermittent energy restriction stuff that you had been kind of recently doing, and I know that Madeline are doing over there with Dr. Tinsley, I'm sure, some of those things. But I don't know if we'll have enough time to really get and dive deep into those things for you. We want to obviously respect your time and everything that you're doing over there. Sure.
We'll do it next time.
We go. Yes. Yes. We would love if there was a next time for sure. And, you know, we really appreciate you kind of coming and talking to us. You know, we've been excited about this since we scheduled this thing. So, you know, it's been great to just talk to you.
Yes. Thank you very much. I'm always happy to talk to anybody.